you get confused about it, it's actually not the S matrix we just heard about. We sort of heard about the what one could call the world sheet S matrix, and this is what one might want to call the space-time S matrix. Please, Zvi.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you about the recent advances in calculating scattering amplitudes in four-dimensional theories. And I'm going to mainly focus on N equals 4 super Yang Mills, but I will also talk about QCD and supergravity. So the last couple years have seen some really remarkable advances in our ability to do calculations, loop calculations of scattering amplitudes. And there are a number of problems that we're really interested in doing. One that's really important to us is the LHC. The LHC is calling us. It's telling us we need to do calculations of multiparton scattering at loop level. In N equals 4 super Yang Mills, which is the most important for this conference, there's a question, can we resum the entire perturbative series? And then in supergravity, there are some basic issues on the structure of quantum gravity that we would like to re-examine now that we have these new tools to deal with the problems of high loop supergravity calculations. So first, I want to explain a little bit about the LHC, what it's telling us. Well, this over here is simulated data from the LHC. In a few years, I hope that instead of simulated data, we're going to have real data. If you look at this picture, what you see is a big mess, lots of particles. We need multi-particle calculations done to high precision, reliable predictions. Predictions which are at least as good as those measured by the experiment. So the experiments have a certain uncertainty, and as theorists, we need to match that. So let me just give you a simple example of the kinds of problems you can run into if you don't do things properly using QCD. So if you look at the early, this is the Atlas Technical Design Report. This is 7 or 8 years ago, and they used what's known as a showering Monte Carlo. This is an approximation. It's an approximation of an approximation in QCD. And then the net result of the plot, this is a plot of missing energy, and this is cross-section, and then there's this pythia here, the black line here. And there's a prediction that you can find in this Atlas Technical Design Report, and that prediction led to statements that at the LHC we're going to discover supersymmetry in 2 weeks if it exists. That statement is completely false, and the reason why it's false is because the calculations were not done properly. Today, we have a program called AlfGen, which is based on doing tree-level calculations, so you actually evaluate the scattering amplitudes in the leading approximation. And what you find, you see over here, we have the Pythia prediction. The black dots are the excess missing energy due to supersymmetry. And what this AlfGen shows you is that basically it looks more or less the same as the black dots. So you can't actually see the supersymmetry over the background of QCD. Okay. So let's just suppose we're a few years from now, and in fact there's some disagreement of between what the experiment measures and what AlfGen predicts. What's it going to mean? Well, I can tell you right now what it will mean. It will mean very little. It will mean that we should have calculated next to leading order. We should have done these loop calculations. So you say, okay, very good. Why not go do it? In fact, this is what needs to be done. Protons into Z plus 4 jets. Well, here's where we're at. This is the state of the art. We're at 5 particles total. No one has done any complete calculations of cross-sections beyond 5 particles. And the origin of the problem, well, here's some amusing numbers. If you're doing 6 gluons, there's 10,000 diagrams. 7 gluons, there's 160,000 diagrams. 8 gluons, 3 million diagrams, and so on. Actually, this is kind of an amusing number because you can't actually get a big enough computer to deal with this But what you can't deal with is these determinants that appear in the integral reductions. Let's call this a grand or grim determinant. It's kind of grim if you ever meet one of these fellows in a dark alley. So what needs to be done? Well, here's the list of everything that needs to be done. This is at the Monte Carlo workshop 2001. And the experimenters came up with a list, and this list is based on the idea that theorists are infinitely strong and infinitely smart, and they can do anything. So all these calculations are free. Well, since that time, so this all needs to be done at leading order, and then next to leading order. And anyway, the theorists at the time said, good luck. Well, since then, now we're 2005, and you can see the big advance is that the list is now smaller. So it's clear, if we're going to get this job done, you can't fool around. You really need some new ideas. You cannot attack the problem the same way that we've been attacking it for the last 30 years. So what's an example of the problem? Well, this is a kind of typical problem. It doesn't matter what theory you're dealing with. If it's supergravity or N equals 4 super Yang Mills or QCD, you got to do an integral. This integral here is about the simplest thing you find in QCD. It's one loop four-point function. It's kind of an elementary calculation at loop level. And we have one integral. There's thousands of integrals, but let's pick this one. Let's just evaluate it. What you find is this. Okay? That's just one lousy integral. And this mess in here is in terms of a basis of known integrals. If you were to take out a microscope, you'd see that there's over there, some places, sitting an integral that's a known integral. Okay, so clearly this is not the way to go. If you're going to be pushing the state of the art, and already at the most elementary calculation you're dealing with this, this is clearly not the way to do things. So what's the problem with Feynman diagrams? Well, the problem is, I think, to actually understand what the problem is, you have to really go back to basic quantum field theory. Right? The problem is, if you're talking about integrals, how do you do this integral? You're already lost. You have to talk about, or at an earlier stage, you got to get started in a way that things are much cleaner. So the problem is that in the standard ways of doing quantum field theory, we talk about off-shell quantities, off-shell gauge-dependent Feynman diagrams. The Feynman diagrams, individual Feynman diagrams, are gauge-dependent. They're not in terms of physical quantities. When I was in first grade, they taught me that if I have a problem in quantum field theory, the origin of the problem is usually that I'm not thinking about physical quantities. We have to rewrite things so that things are expressed in terms of physical quantities. So look right here. See this leg right here, this is a gluon, so we're supposed to take these gluons on the outside are physical, or call them pseudo-physical. Right over here, we have this leg off-shell. It's not a physical leg. This is gauge-dependent. There's unphysical states moving back and forth. What we need is a formalism such that everything is physical. Or let's look at a loop amplitude. Right? We know that there's a loop integral here, and clearly this stuff is off-shell. But what I'm saying is what you have to do is rewrite it so that everything is on-shell. So everything is determined in terms of only on-shell quantities. And here's some wisdom from Schwinger. Schwinger said, one of the most remarkable discoveries in elementary particle physics has been that of the existence of the complex plane. In fact, that's exactly right. This is the guidance that we're going to take. We're going to be looking at the analytic properties of amplitudes. If we look at the analytic properties of Feynman diagrams, they're not very simple because they're not physical, right? These are gauge-dependent quantities. So these off-shell formalisms, they're designed, in fact, to exploit the known analytic properties of amplitudes. The first practical on-shell formalism was at one loop, which is a bit odd because you'd think that you'd first do it at tree level. Right? But in fact, it was first done at loop level. The way to do it at tree level is actually very subtle, and it required some inspiration from Witten, the twister inspiration. now we have these formalism, the MHV vertices. This is due to Cacciazzo, Svercik, and Witten, and on-shell recursion from Brito, Cacciazzo, Feng, and Witten. To do the loop level effectively, in general, then these two ideas can be combined. At loop level, there are, of course, subtrees, so that's the way that you'd like to deal with the loop level, is to combine these two ideas such that everything is done in a way that only on-shell quantities are used. So the first thing, let me just explain a little bit about twisters. I'm not going to say too much about this. So first of all, it's very good to write things in terms of spinners. So this is a gluon polarization vector, and what we do is we re-express the vectors in terms of spinners. In terms of the spinner inner products, this K is the momentum of the gluon. Q is what's called the reference momentum. It's some arbitrary null momentum that you can demonstrate actually drops out of final answers. It's a little bit like light cone gauge. And here's the notation. These spinner inner products, these are just ordinary spinner inner products that you find in the back of Peskin and Schroeder, but they have a helicity projection. And here we have it in two-component notation. These guys are the positive helicity spinners. These lambda twiddles are the negative helicity spinners. So let's do the Penrose transform. Now, why you actually want to do this is not completely obvious, but on the next transparency, I'll show you what you get from this. This twisted transform is a little bit strange. You see, there's a Fourier transform with respect to the spinner variables, not with respect to the momenta. It's with respect to the spinner variables. But you're Fourier transforming only with respect to the negative helicity spinners, not the positive helicity spinners. So it's asymmetric. The transform breaks the parity symmetry. And in Witten's paper, he demonstrated this really remarkable correspondence between, it was really N equals 4 super Yang Mills amplitudes, but at tree level, there's really no difference. QCD and N equals 4 are, for practical purposes, they're all the same at tree level. And he demonstrated this duality, a weak duality between the scattering amplitudes and topological string theory. But from our point of view, unfortunately, I won't have the time to really discuss that. It's really a very fascinating subject. But the point I want to make here is about simplicity. You see, you need to know that things are simple. If you're going to go far in life, it has to be simple. And that's what twister space teaches us. This is the most important lesson, without any question. It's simplicity, and there's an organization to it. Witten's conjecture, he said that in twister space, the amplitudes are supported on curves of degree D, where D is given by the number of negative helicities minus 1 plus the loop level. So let's say with four negative helicities, you'll get a degree 3 curve. And then there's also this degenerate picture. You can take this type of picture and degenerate it into intersecting lines. This is called the disconnected picture. And what you learn from this is that there's an organization and there's a structure to the scattering amplitudes. They are not just some big mess. That's not just some big mess of algebra. There's a logic behind them. And we can exploit that logic. Once you know that things are simple, and once you know that there's a simplicity and an organization, then you can really fly. So here's one example of how you can fly. It's the MHV amplitude. So this was known for a long time already. The tree-level Park-Taylor amplitudes, they conjectured a very simple amplitude for two negative helicities and the rest positive. There's this color decomposition. So these things have been stripped of the color, and then there's some sum over permutations to return the color factors. So it's two negative helicities, the rest positive. This is supported on a straight line in twister space. There's a delta function straight line in twister space. And by studying the twister space structure, Cacciazzo, Svercik, and Witten guessed, I see a lot of stuff is being done by guessing, that in fact these amplitudes could be thought of as vertices, new sets of vertices. These are non-local vertices, See, there are these denominators, non-local, yet you can use them as if though they were just Feynman vertices, and you can just build up the entire perturbative series, at least at tree level. And loop level was discussed by Brandhuber, Spence, and Travaglini, and the bottom line is it works just fine at loop level. Okay, well, loops is really what's important to us. We want to go forward. The key questions that we're really interested in are all loop questions, whether it's phenomenology or it's N equals 4 super Yang Mills or super gravity. It's always loop issues. To attack loops, we use the unitarity method. This unitarity method is, by construction, has exactly the properties that I described before, that everything is being done in terms of on-shell quantities. Right, so we all know about unitarity. There's a two-particle cut. See, you make a cut, and it's re-expressed in terms of a phase-space integral over a lower loop. So this would be the one loop in terms of lower loops. But you need some kind of formalism that constructs the entire amplitude for you in all channels in some simultaneous way. And that's what this method does. It takes these unitarity cuts and also these generalized cuts where you're cutting multiple things. You're demanding that certain propagators be present, and this allows you to construct amplitudes. In fact, this is the way we do all our N equals 4 super Yang-Mills calculation at high loops, is using this unitarity method. So how does tree level work? Well, it's the power of the complex plane. Right? If you can reduce the problem to a single complex variable, let's call that complex variable Z, then you can apply the full power of complex analysis. Normally, when we deal with some complicated amplitude, there are many complex variables, many kinematic variables, each of which is a complex variable. As far as I know, there's no good theorems in complex variable theory that tells you how to deal with such a problem with multiple variables. If you have one variable, then you can really do extremely well. And the basic idea is to use basic factorization properties of the amplitudes under complex shifts. So these are shifts in terms of a complex momentum with a parameter z, such that this is designed, I can explain afterwards how this works, but anyway, this is designed such that the on-shell conditions are maintained. So these are still physical quantities after the shift, just complex momenta. We're using complex momenta. And then what you do is you apply Cauchy's theorem, and lo and behold, from Cauchy's theorem we know that an analytic function that vanishes at z goes to infinity is just given by a sum over residues. We know what the residues are from general quantum paper by Brito, Cacciazzo, Feng, and Witten. You'll be struck by how small it is. If you throw away all the parts that are irrelevant, you'll see that it's about 2.5 pages long, the heart of the proof. Okay? And once it's simple, then you can really do very well. So you can now apply, since it's simple, you can go on to loops. Right? The proof of Witten under with these complex shifts, you now start thinking about amplitudes, loop amplitudes with a shifted momentum. Apply Cauchy's theorem. Use the unitarity to understand what the branch cuts are. It's the analytic properties. It's exactly what Schwinger told us about using the full power of complex analysis in order to calculate our amplitudes. And the general way it goes, so the way we do QCD is you consider this amplitude as a function of kinematic variables and also this extra complex parameter. There are cuts, the cuts we get from the unitarity method, the branch cuts from the unitarity method. Then there's poles. The poles, we use this on-shell recursion. And then off at z goes to infinity, there may be some polynomial and there's some technical jumping around in order to construct a recursion relation that gets these things. David Kossauer will explain more about this. I'm being kind of vague. If you don't know what I'm really explaining here, it's because I didn't really explain it. Okay. So just to show you, we're not playing games. So let's look at this is actually QCD now, and we're talking about one loop QCD with lots of legs. Just for entertainment value, suppose we're talking about 8 points. We're talking about 3 million diagrams. Okay, and this table, just a table of numbers, never mind what the numbers are. The important thing is these numbers exist. It means we can do these calculations. So these are for the scattering amplitude. Oh, one thing I should say is, that's important, is I'm talking about scattering amplitude. There's still a commotion in order to build scattering cross-sections. Okay, so this is, in a sense, the first step of the problem, but it shows that we can do very high points for QCD as needed for the colliders. And the same ideas apply also to Z's and W's and Higgs's and so on. Okay. So the main part of the talk, this is what I want to focus on the most, is N equals 4 super Yang Mills. We want to go to all loop orders. So in 1974, Atuf said that we could probably solve QCD by looking at the planar limit. Okay, it's quite a bit later. It's 30 years later, and we haven't solved it, so of course the right thing to do is to go find a simpler problem, which is of course what everybody has done. The simpler problem is N equals 4 super Yang Mills. And I want to be clear, I'm talking about the same N equals 4 super Yang Mills that you're talking about. Okay? It's not a different one. Now, we know from the NDS-CFT correspondence that in the planar limit with large Atuf coupling, we have to find some kind of magical simplicity. The theory has to become simple. And this suggests that if we could resum the entire perturbative series, this suggests that we can resum the entire perturbative series because it's supposed to be simple. It would not be simple if we couldn't resum it. Okay? So that's the motivation of why, what we want to do. This suggests that there is a way of doing this, to resum the entire perturbative series for the amplitudes. Okay, the Malbusena conjecture does not refer to amplitudes, but nevertheless, this is just intuition. So what do we need to do this? Well, the first thing is we need intuition, right? You're not going to go far in this game unless you're bold. You need bold guesses, and most importantly, the most important thing is you need sufficiently powerful methods that you can actually see what you're doing. You need to be able to confirm your guesses, and you need to be able to guide your guesses. Right? So we need to be able to do high loop computations, for example, this for loop computation. And we have our unitarity method, and this gives us integrands, so we in fact know the integrands. What we also need to do is the loop integrals. There's still loop integrals to do. Well, very luckily, about a year ago, there is a beautiful program by Michael Chacon that allows us to do the integrals by pushing a button. It's really wonderful. It's like being in heaven. And the most important thing is faith and optimism. This is not a game for people who are pessimists. You have to be an optimist. You have to believe that what you're doing is important and that it will be simple. Because if you don't, you'd be a complete idiot to be working on a for loop problem. Well, let me show you one example of a hint of intuition that you can gain. So you got to believe that the things you're going to find are going to be simple. Well, let's look at one loop where we understand things. So in one loop, if we look at N equals 4 super Yang Mills, this is actually for N equals 4 super Yang Mills. There's a box integral. This is a box written in some funny way. So there's a bunch of legs here. There's just one leg here. There's a bunch of legs there. There's a bunch of legs there. And the question is, what does the coefficient of this integral look like in twister space? And the answer is, it has support on three intersecting lines. And this is something that you can demonstrate. You can prove through the use of the unitarity method. That it has this simple structure. And the existence of this simple structure, in fact, implies that the coefficient has to be simple. Okay? And let's say four negative helicities, you get a nice picture like this. Let's say you get box integrals with a bunch of legs here, a bunch of legs here, and so on. And you get four intersecting lines, and these lines are out of the plane. You can have the lines out of the plane. And this you can again demonstrate using various operators that Witten gave us for studying the twister space structure. So, you see, it's simple at one loop. Well, if it's simple at one loop, it's time to be an optimist. It probably means that it's going to be simple to all loop orders. So, let's go to higher loops. So, how are we going to get there? Well, first, let's do one loop. So, how do we do one loop? Well, we use unitarity. A one loop amplitude is given by a product of trees, and then there's some integral that has to be done. The key equation that you need is you need to know what the product of trees summed over all n equals 4 states is. And if you play around with it, after some amount of time, you discover a very simple equation which says that the product of trees summed over n equals 4 states, it's very important that it's n equals 4, is just given in terms of a tree amplitude and then with two propagators that appear. So this is an exact algebraic equation. Okay. So if we apply this to one loop, well, here's the one loop amplitude. We've done the calculation. Using this equation, we've done the calculation. It's given by an A tree. There's some kinematic prefactor, these S and T's. They're called the Mandelstam variables, the K1 plus K2 square. And then here's the one loop integral. The one loop integral has four propagators. The four propagators is two here. And then there's another two from these cut propagators. That makes four. Okay, so we're done with the one loop calculation. Let's go to all loops in one fell swoop. We look at this equation and you say, gee, tree times tree is given by a tree. What does that mean? It means you can do it again, and again, and again, and again. And that's the basic idea of how you go to very high loops. That's where this two-loop integrand came from. This is in terms of scalar integrals. This is like in a phi cube theory. It's the answer summed over all n equals 4 states. And the thing we're after is to try to see if there is an iteration relation, if the two loops is written in terms of one loop, because we believe that the entire thing can be resummed. All right. So here's one loop. It's in terms of some logarithms. It's a fairly simple thing. Okay, two loops is a little bit more complicated. It fills up several pages of fourth order polylogarithms. But they're known integrals. Right, they're known. It was calculated by Smirnov. So we just have to go look up in the paper of Smirnov what the answer is. And what you discover when you look it up is, in fact, exactly what I said is true. Two loops, 4 points, is written in terms of one loop, 4 points, squared, plus some kind of a function. This function is related to the universal infrared singularities. It's, as I'll mention, it's also related to certain anomalous dimensions that are of great interest here. And you see, it's a very nice formula. There's an iteration in terms, there's a zeta constant. This thing here, this 4 point, is just the 4 point amplitude divided by the 4 point tree. And it's a very nice expression, and it's really true that the two loops is expressible in terms of one loop. And in fact, this has also been confirmed by Cacciazzo, Spradlin, and Volovich directly on the integrand. So we did it in terms of doing the integrals. These people are a little more clever, so they do it without actually doing an integral. See, the goal in life is to avoid doing integrals. Okay, how about let's go to endpoints, right? We don't want to fool around. I mean, just 4 points, two loops, you'll say, so what? Let's first go to endpoints, two loops. So how are we going to do that? Well, remember what Schwinger said, the analytic properties. We need to use the analytic properties. Well, we know a lot about the analytic properties. It's the splitting amplitudes. There's a behavior of amplitudes as two legs become collinear. They're supposed to factorize on this pole. We happen to have calculated the splitting amplitude. We knew what the splitting amplitude of two loops was, and that meant that we knew what the analytic properties of the amplitudes at endpoints are supposed to be. And that, in fact, gives us this endpoint formula, a little n here. Now, when you look at this formula, you'll say, wait a second, you didn't do anything except put, see the 4 there? Except put the n there, right? Yes, that's right. But this formula, like I say, you have to have faith in simplicity. This formula has, in fact, exactly the correct analytic properties. This is for the MHV amplitude, so it's two negative helicities, the rest positive. This has exactly the right analytic properties, and it's almost certainly correct. And in fact, we have now a very good consistency check that, in fact, it is correct. This is Cacciazzo, Spradlin, and Volovich, and also we looked at this problem. And the question is, does it work at 5 points, two loops? And the short answer is yes, it does. In fact, the iteration relation is, in fact, correct by explicit calculation for n equals 5. And we did it numerically, I should add, high precision numerically. It would be better to have an analytic proof, of course. Okay, so that takes care of two loops, but, you know, we want all loops, right? We don't want to fool around with two loops. So let's go to three. Now, here's where faith and belief and simplicity was crucial, because you'd be out of your mind to do a three-loop calculation unless you believed that it would work. But anyway, the bottom line is that it does work. Here's the three-loop formula. This is done by explicit calculation. You get there's a technology called Mellon-Barnes integration. This is all due to Smirnov. And you get the answer in terms of hundreds of harmonic polylogarithms, and then there's hundreds of identities that you have to apply. And then after all the dust settles, then in fact you demonstrate this formula here, that the three-loop four-point function does in fact iterate. It's given in terms of 4.3 loops. Is given in terms of 4.1 loop cubed, and then there's one loop times two loop, and so on. Okay, and then this here is again this infrared function. There's a technical reason why I didn't do that, which I can explain later. Let me ignore that question, and then at the end. But yeah, I could have. But just hold on a second. Okay, so let's go on to three loops endpoints, right? So in this case, we don't know what the splitting amplitude is, but hey, it's got to iterate. If the three loop four-point amplitude iterated, then it's a pretty good guess that the splitting amplitude iterates. If that's true, then in fact we have the endpoint three loops. Okay, but why fool around? Let's go to all loops, all legs. So how are you going to do that? Well, the first thing you need is a little bit more information, a little more guidance. The guidance comes from Magnea and Sturman, who tell us about infrared singularities. By the way, these things are all infrared singular. This is a massless theory. N equals 4 is massless, and it suffers from all the same infrared singularities that we know about in QCD in great detail. So that means we know all the infrared singularities. That means we already know almost the entire answer without even doing any calculation, because we know what the infrared singularities are. We know about the collinear limits. We have key analytic information. And in fact, the answer is right here of what it looks like. The complete resummation, this is for MHV amplitudes, is given by an exponential of this infrared function, then one loop, then there's a constant, and then there's this extra piece, which is actually related to the question there. This extra piece begins at order epsilon. So this piece here is not a physical quantity, because it's some order epsilon piece. Let me actually get to a more physical quantity in just one second. This guy here, this is the anomalous dimension that you're going to hear a lot more about, this cusp anomalous dimension, soft anomalous dimension, leading twist, high spin anomalous dimension, or the high moment limit of the Altarelli-Parisi splitting kernel. They're names for the same thing, this gamma k. And this appears in this infrared function here. It's the first term in the infrared function. So first thing is, first of all, let me make it a little more physical, because this quantity I was showing you here is not physical. It has infrared singularities. But we understand infrared singularities very well in QCD. We know exactly how it's supposed to cancel against real emission contributions. Okay. So we can subtract those off. We know that they're going to cancel once we construct a more physical quantity, some kind of a jet cross-section. It's supposed to have a cancellation. So what we do is we subtract off the infrared singularity, and then we take epsilon goes to zero. Epsilon was the dimensional regularization parameter. And now you get a beautiful formula, which is exactly the kind that you wanted, where the all-loop resummation of the finite remainder is in terms of entirely the one-loop finite remainder that's after infrared subtraction, and then some constant. You see, this constant here, this anomalous dimension, had too many names. This guy here has no name, so that kind of balances it. Okay. And this anomalous dimension, this is exactly the one that, in the guess of Eden and Staudacher, using the integrability, it's the one that you're going to hear quite a bit more about. This anomalous dimension, it's just series expanded. Actually, a small typo there. That should be A to the L. A is the Atuft coupling. It's the Atuft coupling in some strange units or another. Okay, and to show you that this formula is extremely non-trivial, I'm hiding in here, this is a scattering amplitude. That means it has many kinematic variables. All the kinematic variables appear, so you get some rather complicated thing in terms of polylogarithms hiding in that resummation formula. Okay. Let me say a few words about the link to integrability. Okay, so I think everyone here strongly suspects that n equals 4 super Yang Mills is integrable. And in the paper of Eden and Spaudacker, they used the idea of integrability to tell us a guess or a prediction for the anomalous dimension of interest. The same one, the same anomalous dimension that appears in our formula appears in the Eden and Spaudacker paper. These first three coefficients we agree with completely from our calculations. Then there's some new predictions here. This f of g, it's actually just it's equal to 1/4 of this anomalous dimension. So this is exactly the same thing that appears over there. And we're going to hear in the next talk about the connection to the maximal transcendentality, which will be discussed in the talk of Lipatov. And you see, if we knew this, if we really knew this thing, then in fact we would have this finite remainder to all loop orders in terms of an overall constant, an e to the constant. You know, just an overall normalization, we would have the entire expression. So this anomalous dimension is of great interest to us. So the question is the conjecture correct? I think a lot of people want to know this. And we are going to have the answer in finite time. The calculation of this anomalous dimension comes from checking our iteration relation to four loops, and then there's a constant that you extract from checking the iteration relation. It comes from a coefficient of a 1 over epsilon square. And we're in the midst of computing this. Unfortunately, we aren't ready to present anything today. But I hope soon we'll have something. So let me finish up by just saying a few words about gravity. So you see, gravity and Yang-Mills are very closely connected. Any progress that you make in perturbation theory of Yang-Mills, you can immediately import into gravity. Right? So you could say, roughly speaking, any calculation you can do in a Yang-Mills theory, like n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, you can do the same calculation in n equals 8 supergravity. So one calculation, you import the information into the other one, and this is done through the Kawai-Lou-Almond-Tai relations, which work at tree level. These are tree-level relations. They come from string theory, but they're true in the field theory limit, of course, because the low-energy limit of a string theory is a field theory. So you see, the idea is that in perturbation theory, any gravity theory, and when I say any, I really mean any states you please here, so any you know, normal Einstein gravity plus corrections like supergravity, is all expressible. The amplitude, the scattering amplitude, the tree level are expressible in terms of tree level through these relationships. So this side is gauge theory, this side is gravity theory. Okay, and the point is that any progress we make on this side, these relations allow us to import it on the other side through the use of our unitarity method. So let me just focus on one particular problem that I think is really important. So when people say that gravity is not, quantum field theories of gravity are not finite, it's impossible to construct a finite quantum field theory of gravity, the question is, why is this really true? You know, the correct answer isn't because everybody says so. Right? You have to look at where this comes from. Right? And it always comes from power counting. So you think you know all the symmetries, namely supersymmetry, and based on the knowledge of the symmetry, you take into account the symmetry and then you make a prediction for what counter terms might appear. And all the previous analyses of this, including ones that we've done, are based on power counting. But you see, we understand a lot more now. Well, first of all, we have a much deeper understanding of these theories. In N equals 4 super Yang Mills, and also in gravity, we know that there are hidden structures. There's all the dualities, the twisters, all these nice twister space pictures. And then the connection between super Yang Mills and gravity through the Kawai-Llewellyn and Tai relations. So you see, the entire theory of N equals 8 supergravity comes from N equals 4 super Yang Mills, the full dynamics, the entire thing. Right? So we can construct the entire perturbative series of N equals 8 supergravity, including all issues of divergences from N equals 4 super Yang Mills. Now, right, that little fact right there should probably make you stop and worry. Right? It's inheriting, this theory here inherits all its properties from a finite conformal field theory. So I think it's time to recheck this question. Now, let's just suppose, for entertainment, we're going to do this by Feynman diagrams. Well, the first potential divergence in N equals 8 supergravity happens to be at 5 loops. So let's do one diagram. There's billions of other diagrams, never mind. So this is just pure gravitons. And you can use superspace. It's not going to make any difference. There's one diagram here. And you can do a little bit of arithmetic of how many terms are in this one diagram. And if you did that arithmetic, there's about 100 terms on each vertex. You know, gravity's a mess. And then there's 3 terms on each propagator, and you multiply it all out. You'll find there's 10 to the 30th terms of algebra without even having done any integrals, without even really having started. Well, you know, this is more than the number of atoms in your brain, right? So you can't do this. Well, okay, here's a different approach. We're going to use the Kawai-Llewellyn and Tai relations together with the unitarity method. The basic instruction goes like this. You start from QCD amplitudes. You use supersymmetry to generate N equals 4 amplitudes, sets of Ward identities that translate amplitudes of gluons into any of the other states. You use Kawai-Llewellyn and Tai to turn it into N equals 8 supergravity at tree level. You use the unitarity method to turn it into loop amplitudes, and then at the loop amplitudes, you can study what the ultraviolet divergences are. I should mention one thing about gravity that's actually kind of neat, and this is in Witten's original paper. He observed this, that you find similar twister space structures in gravity theories. Instead of having delta function support in twister space, you have derivative of delta function support, but in fact, the pictures are exactly the same ones from Yang Mills. You see, I recycled, there's a little recycle. I also recycled these little drawings because the drawings are identical in gravity and in Yang Mills. It's just here we have derivative of delta function support. So to summarize, there's a number of important reasons for studying the amplitudes. One is that the LHC demands that we do loop calculations. And then N equals 4 super Yang Mills is calling to us about the question of whether we can solve the theory or resum the amplitudes. Our interest is in amplitudes. Can we resum the entire perturbative series of amplitudes? And then also gravity. There's an important question is whether the conventional wisdom is correct about not being able to construct a finite quantum field theory of gravity. The way to settle this is by explicit calculation, which is now within our power. And the inspiration we get from twister space, what's been very important, is the idea of simplicity. There's amazing simplicity. There's structures that we can exploit. And I showed you what's most important for this conference is I showed you an explicit conjecture for resumming these maximal helicity violating amplitudes of N equals 4 super Yang Mills to all loop orders. Okay, and in along the path of checking this, we're working on computing this N equals 4 four loop soft anomalous dimension that you're going to hear about in other talks. So in final summary, there's a variety of exciting avenues for further exploration of these amplitudes in QCD, N equals 4 super Yang mills, and in supergravity. Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much for this beautiful talk. Other questions?
Marie? Well, I have two questions. First, when you propose this iterative structure for the n-loop amplitude,
mm-hmm.
It contains the function f of epsilon, which, as I understand, keeps growing and growing every order.
So what are you growing? Well, the thing to focus on is this formula.
Yes.
You see, the amplitude is infrared singular. That means it's full of garbage, and this garbage cancels against real emission. This is the finite remainder. In there, you find the soft anomalous dimension. So it's not f of epsilon. This is the leading term of f of epsilon. This is the anomalous dimension that we're interested in.
Yeah, but concerning the iteration of the amplitude itself, you still have to determine f of epsilon, which can.
No. You have to determine this anomalous dimension. That's what we want. Right. Okay. That's what's really important for this game.
It's one of the outputs of your iteration.
Well, hopefully there'll be some input from elsewhere.
Okay.
About what this f of epsilon. But
yes.
But when we do an explicit calculation to check this conjecture here, then the output of the calculation is this anomalous dimension.
So the second question or comment concerns your last remark about n equals 8 supergravity being potentially finite. You said you want to do calculations. Suppose you do calculations at 5 loops, and it turns out finite.
But you see, the reason why something is going to be finite at, let's say, 5 loops or whatever number of loops is because there's a symmetry.
Yes.
Right? So, of course, you cannot prove anything order by order, but the idea is, remember the faith and optimism, that when you, let's suppose you find the finiteness, that you will then, in fact, know that there's got to be a symmetry there. Once you know there's a symmetry there, you're going to work very hard to look for it, and I assume other people would also look very hard for the symmetry. Once you have the symmetry, then life will be good.
My personal conviction is that the way through to such a proof goes through the off-shell formulation of the theory. If we know this, which is far away from us.
Personally, if you look at the progress that's been made with off-shell superspace, it's not been very great in the last 20 years.
No, it's been abandoned for many years. But,
what's that?
It has been abandoned for many years.
Yes, there's a reason for it.
Okay.
Costa?
I have a question about epsilon. What regularization do you use?
It's a flavor of dimensional regularization that we call the four-dimensional helicity scheme. It's supersymmetric preserving regular. It's kind of related to dimensional reduction.
And it works to all loops?
It works as far as we've looked. The question of regularization and supersymmetry is a bit of a can of worms. So if you ask, well, how do you know that at 17 loops something isn't going to go wrong? Well, I would turn it around the other way, that if you've proven it to some very high loop order, the guess is that the regularization is defined by the formula, that the correct prescriptions, if there's any ambiguity in the prescription of how you're supposed to calculate, you see, the main problem with a lot of, like, the dimensional reduction are ambiguities of how you're supposed to calculate that. So, if you have the iteration formula to guide you, I think you can turn it around. Because the problems aren't going to be until some very high loop order.
Just a matter of principle, there is a supersymmetric regularization that presumably will still.
Siegel problem at four loops.
Sorry, what's that?
A Siegel problem at four loops.
Siegel has a problem with four loops?
Yeah.
I don't know. Are you sure? Last I spoke to Siegel, he said, so what? there's a problem. There's always this problem about that it's not well-defined, but, there's some ambiguities, but that doesn't mean there's a problem. It just means people are confused. It's really a can of worms. One must have faith that this will sort itself out.
Andre?
maybe it's not a question only to you, but for many people here. As far as I understand, nobody uses supergraphs in computing these n equals 4 super Young Mills amplitudes. The naive guess is that using at least n equal 1 supergraphs in computing amplitudes of super Young Mills theory would help. I don't know, to find the symmetries you're looking for. So I don't know. It's not a question only to you, but maybe to everybody here.
It's not. I don't think that the symmetry is directly related to supersymmetry. It's something else. Also, we find superspace to be a little bit clumsy, especially when you're talking about extended supersymmetry. We do things in terms of Anshel word identity. So in a sense, you have the full power of the superspace from the word identities. You can construct an Anshel superspace, which is perfectly fine.
N equals 1 superspace.
I would not touch an off-shell formalism in addressing this problem at all. Anything that relies on off-shell, like N equals 1 off-shell superspace, I would not touch it because I think the right path is to stay on-shell. If you're on-shell, the supersymmetry word identities are much, much simpler. There's no auxiliary fields or any other nonsense to worry about along those lines.
And I guess perhaps the superspace would turn your 10 to the 30 integral or terms into something like 10 to the 29.
That's correct. That's why I wouldn't... you can do all sorts of tricks, but when you're faced with something like that, it's just not going to help. It's you know, or even if it made it, you know, 10 to the 15, or it made it 10 to the 20, you know, 10 to the 10th, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. So I think we should move on, but let's take Tsuyi once again.
I'll give it to you. Yeah. Wait.